Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way to keep on top of the most important news from China in just a few minutes a day with our free daily email newsletter, curated with terrific skill by Jeremy Goldcorn and his marvelous team, as well as our handy smartphone app, and of course, our website, supchina.com. It truly is a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the Fairbanks Center, where I've had a delightful time catching up with old friends and making some new ones. Joining me from his home in Nashville, Tennessee, is the irrepressible Jeremy Goldcorn. Don't even think of trying to repress this man, because it just won't work. Jeremy, how the hell are you, man?
I'm doing very well. Let's get on with the show. We've had the most terrible technical difficulties, and we need to record.
Third time is a charm. Yes, so today, Mr. Jeremy, my friend, we are going to talk about Magnitsky Act. We are going to talk about the issue of adoption. Niet terrorist has nothing to do with Magnitsky Act.
Groan, I said, get on with the show.
All right, Okay, on with the show. So seriously, we are talking about the issue of adoption of Chinese children, primarily to the U.S., of course, and about the many issues that surround this phenomenon. And to talk with us about this are two women who were themselves born in China and adopted at the very young age of just a few months by American couples and raised in the U.S. Ray Winborn was among the very earliest of children adopted by American parents in 1993, only a few months after this kind of transnational adoption became legal. I should add that Ray came up to Jeremy and me when we were doing a show in D.C. afterward and suggested that we do a show about adoption, and we thought that was a splendid idea. And after talking to her and finding out just what a thoughtful and well-spoken woman she is, we insisted that she be our guest and not some putative authority on the subject. So, Ray Winborn, welcome to Seneca.
Hi, Kaiser. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Charlotte Cotter, who is president of China Children International, the first online support and networking organization for young adults adopted from China. Charlotte, thank you so much for traveling to Boston to join us for the show.
Hi, Jeremy and Kaiser. Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, so perhaps let's start with a little bit of a background about each of you. I mean, I've given just a little bit of the barest bones of details, but so Ray, you were adopted in 93. What about you, Charlotte?
I was adopted in January of 1995.
Okay, in 95. And how old were you?
I was 5 months.
And Ray, you were?
9 months.
9 months old. Okay. And so neither of you have any kind of a memory, of course, of China. So you grew up completely in America. And so let's talk about who your adoptive parents were. Ray, you said you grew up in Colorado, right?
Yeah. So I was adopted by a lovely family from Iowa, but we moved to Colorado when I was fairly young, so I consider myself to be from Colorado, particularly in a small rural town, Durango, in the southwest corner. So there weren't a lot of people who looked like me or even minorities in that area.
And your folks were just good old solid Midwestern people?
Right, exactly.
Just sort of solid middle class Americans?
Yes, we ate Hamburger Helper a lot.
And casseroles?
And casseroles.
And shake and bake?
Oh, yeah. Shake and bake was a...
I actually drove through Durango a couple of months ago. I can testify that I didn't see any Chinese people there.
That's a lovely part of the country. That's like that near Four Corners, right? I mean,
right, yeah. So if you drive in 30 minutes, you know, one way you hit mountains, 30 minutes another is plains, and then another direction you have desert, and another you have like red cliffs. Yeah, wow. So it's a great place to grow up. But no other Chinese people.
Charlotte, you had a kind of an unusual parentage situation. Tell us about that.
Right. So I have two moms, and they both were born in Massachusetts. And then I also grew up in Massachusetts in Newton, a city near Boston. And I guess in contrast to what Ray was saying, Newton did have a fairly large population of Asian Americans.
Right. So you were adopted, but you said you were adopted by two moms. You just sort of tossed that out there. But I can't imagine that the apparatchiks who man the adoption services in China would have smiled on a lesbian couple adopting children from China.
Yeah, I think you're right. So what happened was that one of my moms adopted me individually, and then my other mom went back 2 years later and adopted my sister, who's also from China, and she came home at 1 year old.
Oh, wow. Oh, so and interestingly, you actually have a sibling too, right, Ray?
Yes, I have a brother. He was actually adopted from the same orphanage that I was, but he was adopted about a year later. He's 6 months older than me, so we kind of grew up in a faux twin situation, or everyone thought we were twins, and we were extremely angry when they said that. We're like, no, we're not twins.
Can we kind of go a big picture a little bit and talk about the basics of adoption from China to the United States? Ray, you know, I think Kaiser mentioned you were among the very first children to have been adopted from China. So when did it actually start? And, you know, how did the adoption trends play out for the next couple of decades?
Yeah, so China officially open up to transnational adoption in 1992 and has grown steadily, peaking at around 2005. And then in recent years has slowed down pretty dramatically to a very small trickle. Note that this is a phenomenon that's happened to a lot of sending countries, so not necessarily a China-only trend.
Right. I mean, adoption from China is pretty closely linked in the minds of most people with the whole one-child policy and the abandonment of baby girls in a society with a deeply rooted preference for boys. So do you know what the ratio is of adopted boys to adopted girls? I mean, so Charlotte, you actually operate an organization, CCI, China's Children International. In your membership, are there many boys?
We do have some, but very few. I'd say it's about 90 to 95% female.
Oh, wow. Wow, that overwhelmingly female.
Ray, your family is somewhat unusual, I believe, in that you have an adopted brother from China, too. Can you talk a little bit about that and the differences between boys and girls who were adopted from China?
Yeah, so, I mean, I do know some families who also have boys, but they usually have some sort of special needs. So that can vary from a smaller kind of medical issue to a more serious medical issue or even a kind of a more mental issue. And that, I think, plays out in the Chinese preference for boys is that usually they're going to be more special needs. My brother in particular had a cleft palate, which is not necessarily a serious disability. But for, you know, a low-income Chinese family, that can be something that is prohibitive.
Right. I can imagine. As China grew richer and more powerful and as adoptions trickled off, I guess in more recent years, most of the adoptions that were coming out of China were of special needs children, whether girls or boys. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So, a majority of the children who are adopted nowadays are special needs.
Okay. Let me get to the question that really kind of always comes up for me when I think about the issue of transnational adoption and specifically adoption from China. You know, from the mid-90s onward, I would get questions pretty regularly, either from people who had adopted children or from people whose friends or who reached out to me as somebody who knew something about China. And they would be questions like, what Chinese dialect should I teach my baby? Or what are some good fairy tales or bedtime stories from China that I should be reading to my children? Or you know, what are the classic Chinese children's books? And it would be stuff like this. And, back then, I mean, it was sort of the time I lived in, or I thought to myself, well, this is puzzling because, you know, why should a child adopted from China be exposed to that culture, that language, the country of their birth? I mean, isn't it sort of the right of a child in America to be just an ordinary American? Aren't we supposed to be sort of notionally colorblind? Aren't we? I mean, shouldn't we respect the likely, you know, demand that they'd be treated no differently than their biological siblings or their American-born schoolmates? I mean, so what is now the current wisdom on this issue, and has it evolved over time? And how did, I mean, what informed this?
I think that a lot of it comes from pushback from Korean adoptees, who a lot of them have grown up and spoken out on this issue.
Oh.
And a lot of them, I think, were raised with the notion that the parents didn't see race, there was nothing different about them. And they grow up, they grew up and kind of were confused and conflicted about how this very important part of their identity has been overlooked. So I think they have spoken out about educating parents, especially in international adoption, about learning something about the country and reminding the children about their roots.
Yeah, so maybe you guys can tell us a little bit about your own decisions, your own processes of reconnecting with your Chinese, I mean, I don't want to call it heritage, your biological heritage, let's call it. Ray, do you want to start? So how did you start getting interested? What did your parents do, first of all, in terms of trying to connect you with China? What are some of the sillier things that you were subject to? Because I'm sure there were some. And how did you start taking that interest?
Yeah, so I guess my parents, even though they did take the view that you should introduce culture to your child, they kind of had the more minimal approach than, and I think that was one, a factor of where we grew up and the resources that we had access to, as well as, you know, oh, you should be more American, or they had the idea that I think leaning more towards the previous, the previous kind of generation of transnational adoptee parents, where it was more a focus on you are American first. And
what? How old were they when they adopted you? Just may I ask?
Yeah, they were 35-ish.
Okay. So they're baby boomers.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, we did the yearly Chinese New Year event with other adoptees in our community. We went to eat out at Chinese restaurants probably more regularly than others.
What was your sense? I mean, did you feel this is awkward? This is weird? Or did you feel like, no, this is great? I mean, did you feel any kind of sense of connection to, you know, the lion dance you were singing, or the firecrackers, or the songs?
Yeah, so maybe I'm just a weirdo, but as long as I could remember, I wanted to learn Chinese.
Ah.
And I remember one of my dream jobs was to be like a Chinese translator. So I'd always been like, Mom, I want to learn Chinese. I want to go back to China. Their usual response was, where are you going to learn Chinese? And we don't have money to go back to China. So, or you need to be older. Actually, usually it'll be like, we'll wait until you're older. So I, you know, save up, you know, whenever I got birthday money, it'd always go towards my China fund.
And what about you, Charlotte? What about your process of sort of reconnecting with your Chinese biological heritage?
Sure. And I guess I'll preface this with something that Ray made a really good point, that the experiences of Chinese adoptees are just so diverse,
yeah.
Especially as somebody who has interacted with a lot of them through my organization. So I can only speak to my own experiences, and I don't want to or I can't represent all Chinese adoptees. So this is just for me.
That's fair.
So when I was younger, I think it was a lot of having Chinese sort of artifacts around, maybe like a Chinese scroll or a Chinese painting. And then I also had a Chinese tutor when I was younger.
Huh.
And then eventually went to a bunch of Chinese language camps.
Oh, wow. They went full bore with you. I mean,
yes.
they really worked on the whole thing. I mean, and it paid off, because the two of you are quite unusual in that, you know, you are very well connected.
Do either of you know of adopted children who are resentful at having been fed a bunch of China stuff as kids, especially perhaps because it came from white parents who may not themselves have much of a connection to China?
Yeah, so I don't know particularly of anyone who felt resentful, the kind of deep-seated resent that, you know, is particularly harmful. You know, parents make you do a lot of things. So I think to some degree, everyone resents their parents doing something, right?
Jeremy, I bet we have a lot of ABC friends who are pretty resentful about Saturday morning Chinese school, right?
Right.
Every single one I know is resentful about Saturday
but
morning Chinese school.
But they come around to it, right?
Although they change their minds when they try and learn Chinese
exactly.
as adults.
That's the story
exactly.
of my life.
Yeah,
right
so
there.
I mean, I think there is a large majority of adoptees who are probably not as interested as, say, I was, but I wouldn't say resentful.
To go back a little bit, to the question of why parents of adoptive children from China encourage them to learn Chinese, I know tens of thousands, I think, of babies have been adopted from Russia. Do either of you know if parents of Russian adopted babies try to connect them with their Russian heritage? Or is it just because Chinese babies are obviously not white and that's going to cause a need for some kind of explanation at some point? So it's common practice now to give them a dose of Chinese culture.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't have a very large representative sample, but of the very few Russian adoptees that I know, or I guess more white presenting adoptees that I know, there's not that push for, you know, exploration into their culture.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Jeremy. I hadn't really thought about that. I mean, I guess it is. I mean, they can just pass for white, right? And they're not going to, you know, they're not going to feel like why do I look different from all the other kids? Right. That's interesting.
Right. And I think that, you know, goes back to kind of what we were saying of the history, with the Korean adoptees that have really pushed for that, as well as we forgot to mention, the Black community, too, was very much a force in making sure that when Black children are adopted domestically or from international, that, you know, one, that they are, if not able to be kind of paired with a Black family, that there is a degree of exposure to, you know, Black culture.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Fascinating. So how common, I mean, I said you're unusual, but how common is it for children who are adopted from China to really take that keen interest in China itself? I mean, the two of you, you've both lived and worked in China. You both feel a very strong connection to it. I mean, you know, Charlotte, in your case, you are very upfront about your interest in bridge building. You speak excellent Chinese. Are you guys in any sense typical? I mean, is it just incredibly rare to find adoptees who are as engaged in China as you guys are?
I think we're definitely on the sort of extreme end of the scale, but really, like I said, it runs the gamut. And I know some Chinese adoptees who could have less interest in China and really don't identify with that. Then I know some adoptees who are now just kind of coming into college and getting really interested in learning Chinese and going to China. So I think there are a lot of different forms.
And what about you, Ray?
Yeah, I mean, of the adoptees that I've grown up with, I believe I'm the only one who has really pursued an interest in China to really any degree. I have a friend who swears that she's more like Latin because, you know, her interest in Spanish and Latin America is so much more ingrained into her than Chinese culture. So I think, yeah, it runs the range. I think also, you know, we're still a fairly young community, you know, with the peak in 2005. So they're probably high school around now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, perspectives change, interests change. I know that, you know, college was a huge part of kind of forming my interests like deeper and really being exposed to different things. So who's to say that 5-10 years from now, how many adoptees will be living in China as expats?
Yeah, it's so different.
You know,
now.
That doesn't sound that different to me from American-born Chinese,
exactly,
from
exactly.
You know, ethnically Chinese families.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think some of the same factors are in play, like the rise of China. I mean, I look at my children, you know, I think immigrants from a couple of decades ago who would have come over to the States at my kids' age, they wouldn't have dug in the way that my daughter has and been just sort of ferociously proud of China, and it's interesting, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, I have a question for you, Charlotte, about this organization that you've co-founded, China's Children International. What's its mission? How many people are involved? What are you up to?
Right. So we are a group, a support and networking group for Chinese adoptees around the world. We were founded in 2011. And our real inspiration came from, there's a network of families with children from China around America and around the world. And they have like local branches and such. And we were thinking as Chinese adoptees get older, that it was really time that we could create a community of our own. So the dream was really to have a community that was created by and for Chinese adoptees. Yeah, we're still not a huge organization. We have about 3,000 members.
That's not small.
Which is not the entire 80,000, but it's some of them.
No, that's fascinating. So what kinds of issues, I mean, when you say, you know, you're a support organization, what sorts of issues are you or routinely confronted with? What are the common things that people bring up on in your conversations?
That's a great question. I think a lot of them have to do with, let's see, I guess identity, national identity, and how they connect to either their home countries. They're not necessarily American also, or China. There's a lot of discussion about racism and race culture, especially being a lot of times in a transracial family. There's discussion also about trips back to China. And also, most recently, there's been a lot of discussion about going back and searching for birth parents.
Yeah, birth parents. That's the fascinating topic. How common is that for adoptees to travel back to China to look for birth parents? And have either of you done it?
Yeah, so it's becoming a lot more common. Maybe a couple of years ago, there were very, very few who went back, and there really is no precedent as to how you can kind of go back and search, given that we usually have very little information about our backgrounds. But it's been growing in the past years, and people have been getting really interested in it.
Yeah. So now I guess the question is, what do people hope to find? I mean, what is it to satisfy some just basic curiosity? Is it and what are some of the perils? What are some of the pitfalls of that whole process?
I'm curious about the perils, I suppose, because it sounds like it could be, I mean, it would be a very emotional experience.
Absolutely.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think the motivations are different for everybody. Me personally, I've searched. I'd really always wanted to meet them, see whether I looked like them, honestly. And I wanted to ask them about why I had been abandoned, because that was always like a large hole in my story. But yeah, I mean, it's difficult on the one hand because they're right. Like I said, there's no precedent. There's no like set way to go about it. So you kind of have to use your own resources. And then secondly, also, yeah, it's extremely emotionally taxing and it takes a lot of economic resources as well. So I've been really lucky to have been able to undertake this search.
And were you successful?
I was, in fact, successful.
Can you talk about that? I mean, I'd love to hear.
Yeah. So last summer, a friend and I decided to go back and search for our birth parents kind of on a whim. And we put out actually a poster on Weibo, which is the Chinese social media platform that we were searching. And we were hoping that the Chinese netizens would help us spread the word around. And it really took off. And my friend was searching for her foster family and she had a picture on the poster. And then less than 24 hours after the poster was put up, they contacted her through WeChat.
Oh,
wow. It was pretty amazing.
Wow. And what about you?
And then I worked because I didn't really know anybody in the area. So I was contacted after the poster went viral by a Chinese reporter from the local area, which is I'm from Zhenjiang City in Jiangsu.
I know that place.
Oh,
I've played a show there.
Good place. Yeah. And so she worked on the ground, honestly, a lot like without my permission, but she worked a lot on the ground getting a lot of information. And what happened was that I had a note in my file that listed my birth date and my birth time. And then what I didn't know was that there was also something stuck to it that was a little piece of paper that had the hospital in which I was born. So with the information of when I was born and what date and the hospital, she was able to track down the records. And then from the records, she was able to find their address. And luckily, they still lived there. So she literally went knocking on their door and then she called me up and said, "Your birth parents are on the phone."
Oh, wow. So how did that conversation go?
It was a lot.
Were they surprised that you spoke Chinese?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they were really surprised. They didn't know that I had been internationally adopted.
Oh, wow.
They thought that they had made an arrangement with a third party to send me to another family that they knew that had military connections that they thought could raise me. So they didn't know that I ended up in an orphanage, and they didn't know that I ended up in America. So that was a huge shock for them.
Oh, my God. That's remarkable. So who were they? And then did you find out why you were abandoned? Did you find out any of this stuff?
Yeah. So they are actually from the city of Huai'an, which I didn't know. But I was born in Zhenjiang. So they moved from different cities to have. So I have two older sisters, which makes me the third sister. And then I have a younger brother, which I'm not very surprised about. And what happened was they were moving from city to city to have all these different kids to try to avoid the policy. I think they still did have some sort of ramifications from that. And then when they had me, they just decided they thought they didn't have the economic resources to be able to have a third girl, and especially considering that they still wanted to have a son. So what they did was they arranged to a third party to have me sent to another family. I think the third party was because I think the adopting families in China might be worried about the birth families coming back for the kid later on.
Oh, wow. That's just fascinating. And what did you feel? How did you feel?
Yeah, it was wild. Sorry, let me think.
Was it closure? Did you feel like you got your answers? Did it satisfy your curiosity, or did it just open up a million more questions for you?
It did. I mean, I did get that part of the story back, but I think, you know, it wasn't the perfect ending. I mean, I didn't really know what to expect at the end, so I hadn't really like a picture of that. But once I found them, I sort of didn't really know what to do with it. So there has been a lot of like kind of feelings that I haven't yet sort of like addressed
or worked through.
Yeah.
My God. Well, that's why we're here.
It is interesting. So I actually have never tried to find my parents and have had, I guess, a lower interest. I've been curious, but it's never been an important part of kind of discovering my identity. But, you know, there's this story, this kind of fairy tale story that, I mean, it makes a good story, right? Is finding your parents, but that it doesn't necessarily mean closure, and it can open up a lot of different things. And I think, you know, it's good that other adoptees who have had that experience share it, because there is this idea that, oh, I'm going to go find my parents and it's going to be this like magical moment and everything's going to turn out great. And I think people should go in with eyes wide open and right. understanding that it's a lot more complex than that.
Right, right.
I think any journey to explore your past is a bit like that. I mean, my uncle visited Riga in Latvia to see, you know, our family's place. My father refuses to have anything to do with Eastern Europe. You know, people have different attitudes, and whatever experience you have is, it's not going to answer everything.
Well, there's a Goldkorn Shtetl somewhere near Riga, Latvia.
There used to be a Goldkorn Shtetl. The reason they left is because somebody burnt the Shtetl down.
Oh, man.
But enough of the Shtetls. Can I ask both you, Ray and Charlotte, I mean, both of you have spent time working and living in China. What kind of a reception did you have? I mean, I know it's common for American-born Chinese to have certain experiences, such as being castigated for, you know, not speaking Chinese very well. But is there something extra that you experience as a, you know, a transnationally adopted person?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think in general, the Chinese adoptee experience and the Chinese American experience is very similar. I think the Chinese adoptee experience is kind of like the Chinese American experience on steroids. And that's because, you know, we don't have that kind of grounding experience with our families that Chinese Americans can take with them and this kind of basic understanding. So, you know, I remember when I was in China, I was so terrified of speaking Chinese and being exposed for, you know, being a Chinese adoptee and what that would bring up. And, you know, I very, you know, quickly had to learn how to say I'm Chinese adoptee and, you know, like my parents are white, you know, so.
Was there any stigma attached to it? I can't imagine.
Actually, I mean, the reception that I had was fairly positive. They do the like, oh, your parents are so like they're such angels and like you're so lucky and the kind of, I mean, you hear that from Americans as well.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds different though, coming from Chinese and coming from Americans though, right?
Yeah. I think Americans, they should know better than to kind of say those things. So I always give a little bit of leeway for Chinese people and be like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Like I'm very, very lucky, very lucky.
Charlotte, let's talk about some of the best and the worst experiences you've had in China, you know, that maybe relate to your status as an adoptee. What were some of the
Let's see. Well, I guess It is frustrating, I'm sure, as Jeremy mentioned as well, the expectation that you should speak perfect Chinese if you look Chinese, and the kind of confusion there. So I've had a lot of very awkward taxi drives where I'd have to explain my entire life story in about 5 minutes. So that's been definitely difficult. And I think when I went with a lot of foreigners, I think this sort of made it more pronounced. And I did feel a little bit frustrated, honestly, with kind of the lack of understanding of like Asian Americans and sort of that sort of diversity.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point in that your story really is kind of forefront and center in most of your interactions that you have with locals. And I mean, now, you know, in a professional sense, you know, when I've gone over to China or Hong Kong, I mean, it's a common question, you know, like, where are you from? Why do you have a white last name? And I've always, you know,
you're married. You're
yeah.
So young.
Oh, you're married. Yeah. So it's been interesting navigating that. And, you know, sometimes I want to just say, oh, yeah, I'm ABC and leave it at that. But I feel like I'm not that good of a liar or that I'm kind of betraying a little bit of myself. So I usually do say that I am adopted. But it's interesting that kind of dynamic plays out so often.
So Ray just said that it's sort of the Chinese American experience on steroids. Charlotte, does that resonate with you?
Yeah, it does.
I totally see it now. I mean, I totally see it.
Yeah, it definitely does.
It's like it's so many of the same things that we experience, you know, as Chinese Americans, but it's really amplified. Oh my God. I mean, that's maybe the most interesting encapsulation of the adoptee experience I've yet encountered. And yeah, and a lot of these, like Jeremy and I have commented many times, that this is just like, you know, what it is for ABCs. But yeah.
Same, but different, as they say in Thailand.
Exactly.
I also want to mention kind of more of maybe a positive story, since I guess stereotypes is not necessarily the most positive experience.
Right.
So I actually worked at an orphanage for 3 months when I was in China, and that really opened my eyes to, I guess, a lot of, well, the other side of the story, which you don't really hear about and is not really spoken about. And, you know, when I was young, and I don't know if you're kind of given the same story, but you hear that, you know, you came from a place of abandonment, and you're out of the love of your adoptive parents, came into a place of America that, you know, was kind of a win-win for everyone. But I don't think that's necessarily, or I know that's not necessarily true. And, you know, I see a lot of love on that other side from either the, you know, the parents that had to give up their children a lot of times through, you know, forces that they couldn't control, the foster parents and the IEs that take care of these orphans. It's really heartbreaking to find out that, you know, some of these IEs are not allowed to say goodbye to the children before they're sent away or given to their adoptive parents because they're so distraught that they would upset the adoptive parents. So it's, again, it's a lot more of a complex picture than I think the evil mainstream media puts it out to be.
Who are the families who adopt Chinese children? Are there any generalizations you could make about them? Some kind of demographic profile that describes a significant majority of them? Or are they just all kinds of Americans dotted all over the country?
There have been studies of perspectives from the adoptee parents' point of view. And I can't recall them off the top of my head, but I had been researching this in the past. And
did a master your thesis on this, right?
Yeah, it's my senior's honor thesis, but it's undergraduate, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt. Right. it's no PhD. But yeah, so they're usually wealthier, you know, upper middle class. Uh-huh. They're usually older.
Late 30s, 40s,
right. And I guess, I don't know, I think that's the only two characteristics that I can think of.
I'm
going to
guess Jews are overrepresented. I'm just going to guess that.
Yeah, there are many, actually, of Chinese Jewish adoptees.
Yes, my mom is Jewish.
Both of them?
Well, only one.
Oh, okay, see?
I remember there, a couple of years back, there was a New York Times article about like a bat mitzvah ceremony where I think there were about five Chinese-looking girls, you know, being bat mitzvahed from Jewish families.
Yeah, I think that so story may have informed my prejudice. Lily, I totally remember that story. That was great. I mean, adoptee children, pretty much no matter, you know, when it was that they were born, have all watched China's rise. They can't have been unaware of it. So how has the rising sort of wealth and status of China impacted the whole experience of adoptees? I mean, you know, sitting here watching China, I mean, it's no longer a country that you're ashamed of. It's no longer mired in poverty, but it's actually, you know, an influencing force in the world. And it's there's a lot to be proud of, right? I mean, has that changed the adoptee experience? I'm sure it has, but how?
Yeah, I think that there is the tension between feeling really proud about where one comes from, but then also feeling like there's really no connection there. Like we said, when a lot of Chinese adoptees go back expecting to find home, which is all like ABCs as well, they find something that's very alien, and they don't really know how to relate to it. But I think people have been proud of watching China's rise. I know a lot of adoptees comment on the Olympics and how they're rooting for both teams.
I do that too. Yeah. Again, the Asian American experience on steroids.
I think they're sensitive to it. I think when they hear China bashing in the media, something strikes a chord, even if they don't really know why.
Huh. Interesting. No, that's really interesting. Yeah. And we shouldn't report this too loudly because it'll reinforce this crazy notion that the Chinese have that they have claimed to all of us for our blood.
I remember the Beijing Olympics and being very, you know, proud of that moment and very excited. I actually went back to China for the first time the winter after the Olympics happened. So that was kind of a great time to go. My first, you know, journey back to China. I think for me, you know, professionally, because I work with China kind of in my job, that's always been, it's been both a personal passion, but also a huge professional interest. And a lot of that stems from, you know, China is such a crazy place and so many things are happening and it's where to be.
Fascinating.
Sometimes when I think of transnational adoption, you know, I picture Madonna jetting off in her private plane to Malawi to adopt a very photo-friendly child. And I wonder if there isn't always some element of the white savior going on in adoption from developing world countries. It might be entirely well-intentioned. And, you know, I'm sure in 99% of cases it is, perhaps even in Madonna's case. But there does linger a little bit, you know, there is a power dynamic, which I think we mentioned briefly before. Are there devoutly religious people who adopt with the intention perhaps of saving a soul? Or can you talk about that power dynamic?
There's definitely a religious aspect for a lot of adoptee parents. Actually, the founding organization of Korean adoptees, Holt International, you know, came from a religious family who wanted to adopt Korean children because of a path that they felt through their religion. That's not necessarily the case for everyone. That being said, I think, you know, the narrative, the underlying implying narrative that I hear a lot and is threaded throughout the mainstream narrative of adoptees is this idea of the white savior complex. And I think that's why it's so important to have adoptee voices, because up till now, it's a lot of the parents. And I mean, good intentioned or not, that's kind of how either they see themselves or unintentionally how other people see themselves.
Now you guys are all coming, you know, into your adulthood and you have, you know, loud, clear, articulate voices. I mean, because, you know, look, you're one of the oldest ones and you're 25, right? 24, 25, right?
Right. And this is, I mean, these are ideas and concepts that, you know, you don't think about when you're young and then, I mean, even sometimes in college and it's only with a bit of distance and the perspective, the adult perspective that you really become cognizant of the way that stories are told and the way that your stories were told, and like taking that critical eye.
Charlotte, what about you? Do you feel anything about that racial and power dynamic that's at work that creates sort of lingering resentments or any kind of problematic?
Sure. Yeah, I definitely understand it a lot more. I'm seeing it a lot more now. I think I was a very naive child, so I really didn't think that much about adoption or like the sort of larger power structures. But when I did start getting involved in the community, I was hearing a lot of voices speaking up about that sort of inequality, and it challenged me to rethink what I think about adoption. And it's constantly changing.
Yeah, I mean, that's great, and I look forward to, you know, a lot of literature coming out on this as people are sharing their stories. And I hope that you guys both point us to stuff that you come across, because, you know, as people who are paying attention to what's being talked about in the whole discourse on this topic, I'd love to keep an ear open to that. But let's change the subject here and talk a little bit about adoption within China, adoption by Chinese people of Chinese. We talked about this becoming, you know, slightly more common. Wealth is obviously one factor. The end of the one child policy is driving this increase. Is there just sort of less social stigma about adoption? What are we seeing happening in China? Because you've worked in this area now.
I think that domestic adoption is still more uncommon than common. There still is the stigma just within, you know, that you need to have a child of your own and not of, you know, someone else's. That being said, I think that there probably are more. Don't hold me to that as far as solid research or any statistics, but I believe that the government is trying to encourage it more. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's great.
I would imagine that just like philanthropy, which is only in the last few years started to become a thing that rich Chinese people do, you know, it's going to take time, but it's inevitable that it will happen.
Mm-hmm. I mean, have you guys, do you know any local friends who have adopted domestically?
I know local friends who have looked into it. Nobody's actually done it. It turns out that it's actually a kind of, you know, there's a lot of paperwork. There's a lot of, it's quite involved. My wife has a couple of friends who've been unable to have children, and they've looked into it. It turns out to be incredibly complicated, but hey, you know, what isn't bureaucratically in China?
Indeed. So before we get to recommendations, is there any advice, Charlotte and Ray, that you would like to give parents of adoptees or any adoptees themselves who may be listening?
Yeah, just, you know, parting words of wisdom from Charlotte and from Ray.
Of course, it's so hard to make kind of general recommendations just because every adoptee is so different. But I do think personally that I really did benefit from the early exposure to Chinese culture. Even if it was perhaps a little bit superficial, maybe it wasn't really like the most accurate depiction, but I think intent does really matter. And they did try their best. And now, I mean, I guess it's up to the child whether they take to it or not. And I think they don't force it.
That choice available.
Yeah, they make it available.
That's awesome. Yeah. Ray?
Yeah, I agree completely with what Charlotte said. You know, every child is their own. And so it's hard to give, you know, you must make sure that they learn Chinese by sixth grade. But for adoptee parents, I think it's really important to do your research and listen to the
Seneca.
Adoptee voices.
Listen
to Seneca if you haven't already. Listen to adoptee voices. You know, that's not just limited to Chinese adoptees, but, you know, Korean adoptees and other transnational adoptees, because they have a lot to say. You know, they would, you know, benefit greatly from hearing their stories.
You guys have both given me some great resources on this stuff, and I'm going to share that on the website. You know, links to Charlotte's organization, links to a lot of the documentary films that you guys. This is really, really great stuff. So yeah, mm-hmm. You know, there are more and more resources and places where they can hear those adoptee voices that you think are so important now. Yeah,
mm-hmm. And then for adoptees, I think I would recommend to, you know, follow your interests, whether it be China or not. But also, you know, you don't have to package it up with a nice little bow. You know, there can be points where you feel, you know, really sad about what happened, or really happy about what happened, or just not knowing what to feel at all about what happened. And all of those emotions are completely valid. So don't feel like you need to do one certain thing because you're adoptee, or pursue something because, you know, this is what others have said that you should.
That's great advice. And Ray and Charlotte, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Seneca. Stick around for just a few more minutes, and let's make some recommendations for our listeners. Before we get to recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at subchina.com. You can follow SubChina on Twitter at SubChina News, and on Facebook at facebook.com/SubChinaNews. And if you like the Seneca podcast, by all means, please go leave us a positive review on the Apple iTunes Store or on Google Play or wherever it is that you go to review apps. This really helps, and it really does mean a lot to us. On to recommendations. Jeremy, kick us off today.
Okay, I've got two, and they both are from the huge pile of reading matter I have for some upcoming podcasts.
Oh, good.
So the one is Little Soldiers, subtitled An American Boy, A Chinese School, and the Global Race to Achieve, by Lenora Chu, who and her husband, Rob Schmitz, who's been on our show a few times, sent their son to an elite Chinese kindergarten in Shanghai. And it's about that experience and her research into the Chinese education system. And I'm enjoying it very much.
It's great.
And
huh?
The other
it's
is called
book.
The China. It's good. Yeah. And the other is called The China Questions, Critical Insights into a Rising Power. It is edited by Jennifer Rudolph and Michael Sony. How do you pronounce his name, Kaiser?
You know, I don't actually know. I just
Sony,
saw him. Like,
Sony,
not-
Zony. And it's in the form. The book is in the form of, I think, 36 questions, all kinds of questions. Will urbanization save the Chinese economy or destroy it? Is the Communist Party legitimate? Can China's high growth continue? Can China and Japan ever get along? And other questions such as, what is the importance of the great historical novels? And each question is answered in the form of a shortish essay. And at the end of it, many of them, you basically get the conclusion that, well, if things go well, it'll be this way. And if they don't go well, it'll be that way, which is a fair enough conclusion to most things in China, but all very intelligently written and well worth reading.
Yeah, I'm really it's excellent. And the format is perfect. You know, it just sort of. They literally take 15 minutes each to read. They're really, really good. Excellent recommendations. Ray, why don't you go next? What do you have for us?
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, kind of one of my huge interests is just the Chinese language. And given that I didn't have the opportunity to learn about it or learn it when I was younger, I started in college and have continued studying it after I graduated. I think one of my big struggles was, you know, getting over the fear and perceptions of others and within myself of how well I should speak Chinese. And I had about a year ago discovered this private tutoring platform called iTalki. So it's iTalki.
Yeah, it's based out of Shanghai. I know the guy who started it, Kevin.
So I found a great tutor there. And it's honestly, I feel like I have improved more with my tutor via, you know, Skype versus my classes in college. So for anyone interested, and I'm sure there's a lot of viewers that are interested in improving their Chinese, highly recommend it. It's been a great resource for me.
Oh, that's a terrific recommendation. I don't know why I'd never thought to recommend that before, because I actually know that some of the people involved, the people who funded it, and the people who are, it's great. Charlotte, what do you have for us?
For those viewers who are interested in learning more about adoption, I have two movies that I really like. One of them is called Somewhere Between, which I'm sure that a lot of viewers have heard of. It's a story of four Chinese adoptees and very well told. And the second movie is called Twinsters. It's about a pair of Korean adoptees, one of which I actually Sam Funiman is very cool. And so I would really, that's really good. Even if you're not interested in adoption, it's just a really great movie.
Twin Sisters, one of them was raised in Norway or something?
Yeah. Like. Or no, one was raised in France and one was raised in the US. So it was literally the Parent Trap.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Wow, that's fascinating. My recommendation for this week is called The Book of Swindles, which was recently published by Cambridge University Press. It's a late Ming compendium of by this guy named Zhang Yinyu, who his work was translated by Christopher Ray, who is... been talked about on this podcast before. He's somebody whose specialty really is Chinese humor, and he brings a lot of that panache of the humor to it. And Bruce Rusk, the other translator. Zhang Yinyu lived, like I said, in the late Ming, and his book, it's called the Pianjing or the Fang Pianjing. It's either like the book of how to swindle people or how to prevent being swindled. Same thing, really. It's all about the ways that the grifters and the con men and the charlatans prey upon the simple folk in the early 17th century. I've only just started it, but it's great. It's so clever. I mean, it's unbelievable some of the things that people come up with. I think in this age of swindlers in China today, this low trust environment, it may have new currency. And we're going to try to bring on at least one of the translators for a podcast about this book because of its, like I said, it's a current affairs show. But hey, you know, Jeremy, don't you agree it has some relevance to today?
Yes, it does. I mean, swindling, yeah. Well, not only in China. There's a fair bit of swindling about in these United States of America, too, at the moment.
Well, our whole country got swindled in November. Anyway, thank you guys so much. This is so fun. And you guys are wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Kaiser. Thank you, Jeremy.
Let's all stay in touch. And
thank you.
Yeah, you guys are great. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldhorn. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/subchinanews and follow us on Twitter at subchinanews. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care, and thanks again.